The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Anna Jones. Anna is a food writer, stylist, and author based in London, and known predominantly for her focus on vegetables and vegetarian cookery. Her latest cookbook, Easy Wins, celebrates the perfect capsule pantry of 12 modest ingredients that can transform your weekly cooking. Anna, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me, Lara. It's lovely to be here.
Let's start where we always start. Liv sadly isn't here today, but we normally ask our guests, what are your earliest memories of food? What are your earliest memories of food, Anna?
Well, I mean, I think food goes back such a long way, well, for everyone, doesn't it? But I'm part of quite a big family. So on my dad's side, he's one of 12 children. And a lot of my real sort of formative memories of sort of food and eating happen at my nan's house. She's Welsh. She was called Mam. She's not with us anymore, but many of the sort of 12 brothers and sisters used to gather there on Sunday for Sunday roasts, and Mam used to cook a kind of mean Sunday roast, and me and my sister, there was never enough kind of space. There was a tiny little table that sat like three people, and me and my sister would be perched side by side on the arms of an armchair, and we'd sort of tuck into Mam's Sunday roast, always ask for like seconds and thirds and fourths of Yorkshire puddings. And I just remember that being a constant from a kind of very early age. Also, a couple of my dad's brothers and sisters worked at the Cadbury factory. So I always remember as well, when we were there, when we were at Green Acres, which is the name of the house, there'd always be masses of Cadbury's chocolate. And to me and my sister, who, weren't allowed that kind of thing all the time, it just felt so thrilling. And yeah, I guess also sort of early cooking memories, you know, lots of cupcakes and baking and stuff. But my mum sort of got me cooking proper food, you know, actual dinners quite early on. So yeah, there's definitely memories of, you know, making macaroni cheese and stuff and helping mom, but also doing it myself.
You've said before, as a child, you were the sort of child who always wanted to cook for your family.
I definitely started off, as most kids do, with kind of cupcakes and biscuits and baking. And then I think I used to make like fruit salads and things like that. I guess that was a really good way to sort of practice chopping. But pretty soon my mum bought me lots of sort of kids' cookbooks, and I ended up making sort of roast potatoes. I ate meat back then. So I think I used to cook like, this funny sort of chicken breast with like tomatoes and breadcrumbs on top, which now I'm, you know, this was like the late 80s, so there was definitely an 80s spin some of the food. So all sorts of things. It wasn't just kiddie cooking. And I kind of, my mom, she doesn't love cooking, so I was very much learning from these cookbooks. But I really respect my mom for not sort of like, you know, pigeonholing me into that kind of kiddie cooking and really giving me the license to kind of cook dinners and do the whole thing. Yeah.
What about school food? Do you have happy memories?
I do sort of have happy memories of school food. I really loved kind of home economics. We still had home economics lessons when I was at school. And I had a very strict home economics teacher, and I didn't really love her, but I loved the act of cooking. And I, you know, we made sort of really unuseful things like peppermint creams and lots of recipes that I have never repeated apart from in those classes. But the actual school food, yeah, I think was pretty nice. I think I always look forward to lunchtime. I was a big fan of the puddings and the custards and, you know, the semolinas, all of those kind of really classic sort of British school food things that I think lots of people are traumatized by. I actually quite like. So yeah, I think I always quite look forward to school dinners, and I was probably reasonably easy to please.
And talk us through your kind of early career and what the food like was like at that stage of life, and then how you decided to move into a career in food.
Yeah, so I did an economics degree, which obviously has nothing to do with food, and I really wanted to work in kind of like development economics, like with sort of third world countries. I had grand sort of designs of working for the IMF or the World Bank, and then I realized how many PhDs you might have to do to be able to do that. And I sort of had a bit of a rethink. So yeah, I was working in kind of PR and one day read an article in the Times Educational Supplement about how I think I was at one of those sort of points in my life where I really wanted to work out what it was that I was going to do and what it was that was going to be the kind of purpose, I guess. And this article was really interesting. It said you should determine your calling by the part of the Sunday supplement that you turn to first, like that's your immediate passion. And it was actually such a useful tool because to me, it was so clear then that I always turn to the restaurant section. I always go to the recipes first. And, you know, I'd always cooked as a kid. And I used to cook these elaborate dinner parties for my mom and dad and their parents. But it never really occurred to me that food could be the thing. And so I guess that was, you know, sort of the light bulb moment, if that doesn't sound too glib. But yeah, that was the moment. And then from there, things happened quite quickly. I then went into the job that I was doing, Googled cookery courses in London and found a cookery course that Jamie Oliver was running called 15. And a couple of weeks later, I was kind of enrolled on that course and cooking for a living. So, yeah.
And at that stage, you obviously mentioned earlier that you used to eat meat and then you became vegetarian. At what stage did you become vegetarian?
Yeah, so that was probably 5 or 6 years into sort of cooking professionally. And I guess I'd been cooking a lot. I'd been eating a lot at that point. I was working for Jamie Oliver, but I was working for him kind of in his kitchens, helping doing recipe testing and tasting. And it was a wonderful job. But I just felt like I was eating and cooking and tasting a lot. And I wanted to kind of spend a couple of weeks eating more simply, I guess, a reset of how I was eating. And so for a couple of weeks, I just decided to eat very cleanly and simply, just loads of fruit, loads of veg. It wasn't anything to do with losing weight or detoxing or anything. It was just a sort of need for simplicity or to sort of reset things. And yeah, I just have never wanted to eat meat or fish again. I think the moment I took it out of my sort of day-to-day, the more abstract it became to me to eat it. So it wasn't a gigantic kind of ethical decision at the time, but it has subsequently sort of become something I've obviously looked into and the ethics of, both in terms of animals and in terms of environmentally. So that's when it happened. And it was quite interesting because as a young chef at that time, it was really a time when sort of nose to tail eating was the thing. You know, St. John's had just opened up and all of the chefs that I was cooking with, they were sort of heading towards the sort of offal side of things. And I was going towards the kind of carrots and beetroot. So it felt quite a diversion. And at the time, I wondered if it was going to be something that would sort of stifle my career and my cooking a bit, but it felt like the right thing to do. So
I have to say your vegetarian recipes are incredibly delicious. What do you think is the kind of secret to cooking very good, delicious vegetarian food? Because I suppose it sometimes has a reputation for perhaps being a bit bland, but your food is not at all bland. So what's the secret?
Yeah, I think vegetarian food and sort of plant-based, if that's a term that we want to use. I'm never quite sure how much I love that term, but I think it has had a reputation for being bland or boring or worthy. But I think things have really changed, thankfully. And I think with vegetarian food, it's about, as with most food, it's about layering flavor and texture. And sometimes you do have to work a little bit harder for that in vegetarian cooking, because, you know, if you've got a piece of meat or fish at the center of your plate, then you're automatically going to have a number of textures. But that also comes with vegetables. I think if you cook vegetables in the way that you might meat or fish, roasting or searing, then you're still going to get that texture. But to me, I think it's about thinking about flavor. It's about thinking about making sure you have sweetness, acidity, umami, all of these, you know, five tastes. But it's also about thinking about texture and making sure that there is sort of textural interest. It's about thinking also about the variety of things that you have on a plate. And my most recent book is all about kind of really sort of simplifying things down to a kind of capsule pantry and not too many ingredients and sort of quick and easy recipes. But in doing that, I think you can still think about a fully rounded flavor.
And talk us through the capsule pantry. What are the key ingredients?
Well, there's 12 of them, and it took me a while to kind of land on those. And I'd spent a long time sort of looking back at the recipes of mine that were the ones that people seem to cook a lot and the recipes that I cook a lot in my kitchen. And I wanted the ingredients to all be things that weren't to me anyway, unusual things that were affordable, things that everyone can have in their kitchen. So there's 12 of them. There are, this is going to be a test if I can remember them all now. We've got lemons, we've got vinegar, we've got tomatoes, we have got capers, miso, peanut butter, garlic, onions, and then I'm probably missing two. Olive oil and mustard, sorry, yeah. So they're just, to me, they're the ingredients that I kind of lean on when I want food to taste a sort of unreasonably delicious for the amount of time and effort that I've put into it. So even though I'm a cook, I have two young children and lots of things, and I'm not saying that children are prerequisite to cooking quickly. I think we're all in a situation where we probably spend less time in the kitchen than we might have done 5 or 10 years ago, or our parents' generation might have done. But we all expect so much more from our food because there is this brilliant explosion in kind of food media and in accessibility to recipes and different cuisines. So we want so much more flavor from our food, but we want that to happen in sort of less time. So I think actually we need, you know, to be quite smart in the kitchen. And I think these ingredients that I've sort of chosen as my capsule pantry, like harissa or miso or mustard, a tablespoon of those comes from a jar that sits very happily at the top of your fridge, asks nothing of you for months and months on end until you want to get it out, unscrew the lid and dollop a tablespoonful, you know, of harissa in, you know, a delicious chickpea and kale stew, for instance, or smear some miso on the bottom of your toasted cheese sandwich, or, you know, scatter some capers into olive oil and pour those crispy popping capers over a bowl of pasta. And it's those really simple things, I think, that are humble ingredients, but if used in the right way, can really amplify flavour.
And you're also obviously known for your food writing. Who are the food writers who you turn to? And I suppose also in particular, the ones who've perhaps pioneered vegetarian food writing, who do you always turn to?
Oh, well, there's so many. I feel like we're just in such, and I think the last sort of 10 years or so have just been such an amazing time for food writing. Because I remember growing up, you had lots of male chefs with recipe books, and then there was kind of Delia and Nigella, but there didn't seem to be like a breadth, to me anyway, as a kid growing up on the outskirts of London. But it's so wonderful now that we have, like, you know, such a depth of voices. Growing up, I just loved Nigella. I absolutely idolized her, and she kind of represented a woman cooking in a way that felt unfussy and not very stiff. And she's clearly a wonderful writer. So she's always been very dear to me. And sort of as I've grown up, I always love to read, you know, Nigel Slater and his kind of storytelling. There's so many kind of other writers that I love to read to. Rachel Roddy, I just think her writing is like poetry. And I just always have a yearning to be in Italy. I haven't been for years, and I just, every time I go, I just don't wonder why I haven't moved there. there are manifold reasons why I haven't moved there, but she just has a way of transporting you with her writing so beautifully. And then I think there's really amazing stuff happening kind of outside of traditional books and media on, you know, wonderful newsletters and stuff. There's a newsletter that comes from someone called Alicia Kennedy, who writes out of like San Juan. And she, I think her perspective is so interesting. And I think it's so nice that we've now got this other way of connecting with writers that means we don't need to buy a paper. We don't necessarily need to be buying a book. And there seems like a sort of this sort of newsletter culture that has come up in, especially around food, I think is really, really interesting.
And talk us a little bit about your work as a food stylist. We've had food stylists before on the podcast. It's always interesting hearing some of the kind of, I don't want to use the word tricks, but some of the techniques used to sort of make the food.
It's a wild old world. So most of my work as a food stylist, I really only sort of work on my own books and pictures now. And the sort of food styling I do is not really, I would say, food styling makes it sound a lot more complicated than it is. It is really cooking and then just taking a little bit more care in the way you put things on a plate. But for quite a few years, when I was beginning to write my books, and before that, I worked on sort of food commercials and stuff. And that's where the tricks really, really happen. I mean, using kind of like white margarine instead of ice cream so it doesn't melt was one of the tricks. There's very wild things. I mean, one of the tricks to use steam was was to use a tampon, basically, and microwave a tampon because it's really dense cotton wool and it would release steam really, really quickly. So that was always a really kind of glamorous moment. and I mean, there's all sorts. I know I haven't done it myself, but I have known food stylists who've used kind of wood varnish to varnish turkeys and things like that. I think that happens less and less now. I think that was a real sort of it's a phenomenon probably of advertising and films and really doesn't happen in the kind of books and photography for magazines and the kind of much looser food photography that happens these days. But it's always fun to think about. Everyone loves a bit of a behind the scenes.
It's true. And when you're writing a book, how do you approach it? How do you come up with the recipes? And are there any recipes from any of your books that have gone particularly kind of viral that you feel like you've become known for?
Oh, yeah, good question. I feel like, yeah, the whole book writing process it's really fun, but it does take a lot longer, I think, than you ever expect it to. I think it's a bit like my books sort of slightly, in a very abstract way, sort of feel like, not like children, but I feel so fond of them. But there are points at which I really wish that they would behave differently. In the same way I do with my children, you know. It's so funny. I spend a long time kind of really looking at what I think would be useful to people, because I feel like there's a lot of cookbooks in the world and I feel like I don't just want to add another one to the pile. I want a book that has recipes that I hope will become cooked again and again in people's homes, and I want to give, as well as the recipes, I want to offer more information than just something that exists in one recipe. So in this book, Evie Wins, for instance, there's lots of thoughts on kind of flavor and how to build flavor and texture and how to do that kind of simply and easily. There's also some reminders about how to cook kind of sustainably. So I sort of really want people to walk away with things that they can use across every single meal they ever make rather than just in one recipe. So that's always sort of the basic sort of premise of things when I start writing, is like, how can this be useful? And I think when I first started out as a chef, it wasn't that. It was like, how can this be different? How can this be something that no one has done before? And how can this use like crazy interesting flavors? And I've realized that actually those recipes aren't that useful to people. The recipes that are useful to people are the recipes, like you say, the ones that have become popular are the simplest ones. So I made a one pot pasta recipe, and a one pot pasta is just basically when you put the pasta and the cooking water all in the same vessel and bring it to the boil, you know, as opposed to sort of cooking the pasta and the sauce separately and then bringing them together at the end. And it was just a very simple recipe with loads of cherry tomatoes, lots of kale, lots of lemon zest, some olive oil and some salt and some spaghetti in a pan. But it was so easy. And I think, you know, there was only one pan to wash up. It was ingredients that anyone could get from their local shop. And it's definitely, I think, my most cooked recipe. And there's a dal from my first book, I think, which is a sort of sweet potato and coconut dal. Again, pretty easy. You have to get a few spices out of the cupboard. But apart from that, it's sort of simple things that everyone can get their hands on. And I think those are kind of the key, really, to recipes becoming loved. I think in my last book, there was a sort of baked cauliflower with potatoes and chopped up whole lemons with mustard seeds and curry leaves, if you could get them, and coconut milk. And that one just became, it's quite an easy recipe, but it's quite a nice kind of centerpiece. And I think quite often when you're cooking vegetarian food, people struggle a bit to think about what they're going to put kind of in the middle of the table. I think we're still quite conditioned to think that we should have like a thing, you know, to build the meal around. And so that recipe, I think, was popular because it was tasty, but also for that reason, that it was the thing. It was the thing to put in the middle of the table.
And what about when you're cooking at home?
So yeah, my husband eats a bit of fish sometimes, but at home we just cook completely vegetarian, and that's not because I'm sort of wagging my finger at anyone. It's through all of their own individual choices. I've got a very little boy who's one, and obviously he hasn't really been able to choose yet. But my 8-year-old, I have given him the choice, and I've said, if you want to try anything, then absolutely do that. Because to me, I think the most important thing is not putting yeses and nos and sort of emotional weight on any particular food. Obviously, I have my own sort of belief system around not eating meat, but that's my choice. And I don't think that you can encourage people to make You know, I obviously believe that the world needs to be eating a lot less meat for environmental factors, but lots of other reasons. But I don't think the way to get people to do that is to tell them not to eat meat and to wag your finger at them. I think the way to do that is to make absolutely delicious food that feels celebratory and generous and joyful. And hopefully that's why my son connects with eating vegetables. At the moment, he says that he's very proudly vegetarian and he doesn't want to eat meat, but who knows, that might change.
Oh, I'm sure I imagine your cooking for that seems delicious.
Well, who knows, because he only eats about 50% of my cooking, but that's a whole nother story.
And what for you is ultimate comfort food?
Oh, I guess for me, that's so dependent on mood. I have such strong associations with kind of different foods for different sort of reasons and at different points in my life. When I was pregnant with Dylan, my first son, all I wanted to eat was mashed potato, really buttery mashed potato. And I'm not quite sure how much nutrition there is in that, but it just felt like the most comforting, nourishing thing at that time. But to me, I think pasta is probably my greatest comfort food. It's something I sort of, since my years cooking and as a young chef, pasta was one of the things that I learned first to make fresh and you know, cook properly. Yeah, to this day, I mean, I don't think for me, like a sort of really good tomato, buttery sort of tomato sauce with spaghetti and lots of parmesan and basil is hard to beat as sort of a plate of comfort. Oh, there's a recipe in this book actually, which is like a broth with sushi rice in, and I make like a quick pickle out of sushi ginger and some garlic, and that's cooked very quickly, and it sort of flavors this broth with the rice at the bottom, and it feels like that's now become what I make when anyone in our house is kind of under the weather. And there is a sort of deep comfort to that sort of brothy sushi rice. So I guess it sort of changes depending on what's going on.
Mm. You're based in Hackney in London. What about when you're eating out? Are there any restaurants that you particularly gravitate towards? If you've got a favourite?
Yeah, well, with young kids, I feel like all my favourite places are basically within a 2-mile radius of my house, so I'm quite boring. But there are so many. I feel like we're so lucky where I live and generally in this city with just so much amazing food to choose from. There's a place called Lucky and Joy down the road from me, which is a kind of Chinese, I guess, Sichuan influenced place, and I really, really love the food there. It's kind of bright and so flavorful, and I really crave it. There's also, there's a great little Vietnamese cafe called Hai Cafe that I think has Vietnamese like food like I've never really eaten before. And then there's all sorts of wonderful treat restaurants like Rochelle Canteen, Cafe Cecilia Spring. I mean, I go to those about once a year. It's not like I'm there all the time, but I feel like there's just such a wealth of amazing places to eat around where I live. So very lucky.
And just to finish, Anna, we always ask our guests what their desert island meal would be. What would be your kind of ultimate meal?
That's such a tricky one. I've been asked this question, I think, before, and I think I've given like various different answers. So I'm nothing if not completely inconsistent on this, but I think I would probably say at this particular moment in time, like a sort of South Indian thali, those beautiful tables full of food, full of pickles and rotis and rice and, you know, lots of different kind of, I love particularly South Indian food. I love that combination of mustard seeds, curry leaves and coconut milk. It also seems to be like quite a lot of lemon used there. So they're some of my kind of favorite flavors. And I always feel like in a thali, you get, you know, there's lots of hands reaching over, there's lots of sharing, and you get lots of different interesting kind of flavors. So I think that's probably where I would go.
Well, Anna, thank you very much for joining Table Talk today. And Anna's latest cookbook, Easy Wins, is available now.
Thank you very much for having me. It was lovely chatting.